What's the worst advice you've received?
Oh, God. Go and work for Harvey Weinstein.
From ABC, it's No Limits. I'm Rebecca Jarvis, and each week we're talking to the most bold and influential women playing at the top of their game, trying to demystify success and what it really takes to get there, and all the trade-offs. Whether you're looking for answers or you just want to hear a good story, you're in the right place. Happy New Year to my No Limits family. I hope everyone had a great holiday season. Hopefully that feeling of it's all behind us isn't too depressing. This is our first episode of 2018. It's been about a year since we launched, and I want to thank all of you so much for the support, for making No Limits a reality, for listening, for subscribing, for leaving great reviews, for sending me notes on Twitter, the tweets that you send. I sincerely appreciate it so, so much. And we are really looking forward to continuing to build on what we've been creating here at No Limits and sharing more amazing guests with you. So without further ado, on today's episode, we have a woman who has made a massive mark on the publishing industry. It cannot be understated. From chronicling the life of Princess Diana to completely turning Vanity Fair around, she is an author. Tina Brown knows how to get your attention. Whether it's 1980 or 2018, she continues to captivate the audience. Tina Brown, welcome to No Limits.
Good to be here, Rebecca.
I'm thrilled to have you here. You have an incredible story. 25 years old, you become editor of Tatler.
Correct.
You move to the U.S. and at 30 years old, ultimately become the editor of Vanity Fair. You work there at 29, but you ultimately become the editor, completely turn the magazine around. It was desperate for a turnaround at that point. No advertisers. People weren't stepping up to the plate. You did. And now the Vanity Fair Diaries, your book, and you've published your diary entries from 1983 to 1992. Why on earth would you do such a thing?
Well, you know, I was going to write a memoir, and I have always kept a diary from the age of about 10, a voluminous diary for over many years. And I was kind of going through the diaries for the memoir, and I came to the whole kind of section of Vanity Fair, and I just found it, frankly, such a wonderful surf through the wild ride of the 80s. And there was so much of it. I mean, that was the time I was most prolific. I mean, it was a sort of every night I would come back and write these voluminous entries because my eyes were wide with having arrived in America, and I just wanted to unload to the pages of my diary. And so I thought, you know what, I would have to cut so much of this to do a real memoir. Mm. I don't really want to because there's something really fun about not knowing what's going to happen next. And in a way, it's the kind of the story of the ingenue, you know, who kind of gets there, arrives in a taxi, bumping along from, you know, Kennedy Airport.
With Dr.
Suitcase,
Ruth on the radio.
Listening to, you know, the driver is listening to Dr. Ruth Westheimer graphically describing a sex act. And I'm thinking, what am I doing? Where am I? How can this, you know, where am I coming to? And from that moment, really, it's the sort of the journey of this sort of young woman who really doesn't know anything about America, understanding, learning about America, battling with the sort of media big shots and coming into the court of Condé Nast. And it just felt like a very amusing narrative once I edited that line, as it were, out of the diaries.
I think what's interesting, you are a natural observer, and we talk a lot on No Limits about things that might appear to be things that would harm you or be harmful to you. But being an observer, even being an outsider, is part of your strength.
Yes, well, I've always been a kind of beady-eyed observer. I have a writer's temperament in that sense. And I've always, my father was a movie producer, and I was sort of raised to think about life as material, you know, the search for material always. So I guess I was raised with that, you know, mindset, if you like, of everything is the material. What is it going to be used for later? And that's really been my approach all along to every experience I've ever done, good and bad, has been like, oh my gosh, this is such amazing material. It's going to become something, you know, a magazine piece, a book or something. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been my attitude throughout, really.
I remember when I was starting out as a journalist, and I still do this, but everything was a story to me.
It's true. And if you have that gene, which you obviously do like me, I mean, you're a kind of a news junkie and you're like an open pour. You know, everything kind of comes pouring in.
And you think about how it's going to work and how you'll play it out.
And you think, my God, that's an amazing story. That's an incredible lead. Does anybody know what's going to happen next? And it's just either you have that story greed or you don't.
Speaking of your father, you got kicked out of school 3 times and your father was always there to do what most parents wouldn't do.
My father always took the view, and one of his favorite lines when he was summoned by the head teacher to deal with me, he would say, "How terrible for you to have failed with this extraordinary child." And then it would be, come on, Christina, we're leaving. You know, it's like an out we would go. It's like, bring your case, bring your trunk, we're going. And head held high, you know, my parents would sweep out with me in their wake, you know, carrying a huge suitcase full of, you know, things that I've been kicked out of school with.
This is going to sound terrible, but it reminds me of the bumper sticker that's like, my kid can beat up your kid. Like the parent who's proud for the wrong reason. But it doesn't seem like he was encouraging you to beat anybody up.
Parenting. I'm sure it failed every test. You know, no accountability. But here I am. I was always a very disruptive kid. So, you know, he kind of endorsed that, which is perhaps why I'm a journalist today.
Disruption. And to make that decision to be, you know, in your early 20s, mid-20s, living where you grew up in the United Kingdom, to make that call to come to New York, how did you think that through at the time?
Well, it was a bit of a dance. I mean, you know, I was editing Tatler, which is a small, you know, glossy magazine in England with a kind of insurgent band of young friends and Turks. We had a tiny budget, but we made a great success out of it. We were bought by Condé Nast Magazines, which is, you know, the mighty American publishing house. And once we were in the kind of Condé Nast family, we therefore became much more cognizant of what was happening, you know, in the mothership in New York. And we began to hear these kind of distant strains of the launch of this new amazing magazine, which was bringing back the old legendary magazine Vanity Fair from the 30s. And, you know, Vanity Fair, I had all the collected books about Vanity Fair because I was always a magazine junkie, loved magazines, you know, defunct magazines, current magazines. I just was a junkie for magazines. So Vanity Fair had a lot of glamour and appeal to me, you know, the great photographs by Steichen and Steiglitz and all of these great people and the pieces by Claire Booth Luce and Dorothy Parker. You know, it was a very glamorous era in publishing. So when I heard about the launch of it, I began to get a little sort of tingle thinking, you know, wow, I wonder what that's going to be like. But then when it was launched, you know, it was a total turkey. They got the first editor wrong. They put another editor in and he was wrong. And it just went from being this glamorous icon to being a bit of a laughing stock, at which point they thought at Condé Nast, well, let's just give this young woman in London a go. You know, we bought this magazine in London. Why don't we just give her a go? And they brought me in first as a sort of consultant for the first few months. And I was able to, therefore, it was a bit like being at summer camp before real school. I was able to look around and realize what it was that they were doing wrong. I mean, it just seemed that they had misconceived entirely the way the magazine should go. It was
out of touch. Did it concern you at all that going into a loser could be the downfall?
You know, I think when you're young and sort of very ambitious, which I was, I mean, in many ways, this book is a kind of serenade to young ambition. I was very sort of full of aspiration and full of energy and full of self-confidence in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, I these guys can't, they don't know what a magazine is. I know what a good magazine is because Tatler was a very good magazine. We had no budget, but we did have a brilliant young staff and they were doing amazing things. My motto there was, if you don't have a budget, get yourself a point of view. So, I mean, I had a real point of view about everything. And I thought, this magazine has no point of view. I can bring this point of view, which was my own kind of skepticism of the world. And I wanted to do it, I realized, by the end of my consultancy. But I went back to London. I didn't think that there was going to be a job for me. I thought the second editor was probably going to stay there for the next couple of years. But then I got the call, you know, which was to, would I come back for an interview? And I was on holiday at the time, actually, with my husband in Barbados, as it happened. But I pretended that I was like, it was no trouble to come to New York.
Of course.
What about tomorrow? Sure, I said, in the beach. You know, I had no clothes, right? I had only had a sarong with me. You know,
so make it work.
Exactly. I came into New York. I went rushed off and bought something to wear and had the job interview. I was offered the job on condition I started right after Christmas. And so I didn't go home again for 3 years. I literally had arrived in New York to edit Vanity Fair with a suitcase full of sarongs and flip-flops. And stayed for the next 3 years before I really went back to London, you know, before I got my head up to go back to London and get all my things and you know, we rented our house and all of that. So it was a very, very exciting time. And I was plunged into just turning around a flop. And, you know, I just dug in straight away. And, you know, I had wonderful time in a sense because there was a lot of good material, a lot of good editors and a lot of very, very wonderful things that were in the drawers of that office that no one was looking at. And I went in over the weekend and I started ransacking the art department looking for something I could publish in the first issue. And I opened a drawer and lo and behold, there was this amazing unpublished portfolio by Andy Leibovitz, who'd been sort of hired but wasn't being used at the time. And I unpacked this folder and in it were these fabulous pictures that Annie had taken of comedians, pictures like, you know, the famous Whoopi Goldberg in a bath of milk, you know, which was such a, became an iconic Annie photograph, or Pee Wee Herman hanging upside down from a lamp, you know, hilarious pictures that she took. And I said, let's call this, it was the April issue. I said, let's publish this in 8 pages, called it April Fools.
Of course.
And it was just magical. It really was. And we sort of went from there. I redesigned the magazine with the art department in a long weekend. We made it much crisper and stronger looking, and threw out all the kind of busy typefaces and all the kind of messy layout that was so confused looking, and did something that was very strong and clean, and really created the look of the magazine as it is today. I mean, it's changed very little. We created a front of book section called Vanities and a back of book section, you know, called Fanfare, which was about the arts. And we, you know, we did a changed the covers for into being kind of well-known celebrities, from which it's continued to this day.
And provocative.
The first cover was it's called Blonde Ambition, and we did a wonderful portfolio by Helmut Newton of all the sort of rising blonde actresses in Hollywood, and we called it Blonde Ambition. And I put this new actress, Daryl Hannah, as it was, on the cover blindfold, carrying the two gold Oscar statuettes, like the Statue of Justice, you know. Blind Justice. And it was very sexy and provocative, and had a kind of slightly edgy S&M flavor to it, which I wanted to do because I said, you know, we've got to show right away this is getting away from stuffy sort of New Yorker wannabe, which is really what it was. And immediately there was a buzz about it.
How much pushback did you get at the time when you came in with all these new ideas?
Well, it was not a friendly staff, obviously, because I'd inherited a staff that had had two editors in 9 months, and they certainly weren't looking for me coming in from London. Who was I, you know? So there was a lot of political difficulties for me within. My major thing I had to do was to sort of circumvent the politics of Condé Nast itself, because it was like the court of Louis XV at the time. You know, there was Cy Newhouse, who was the august family owner who owned Condé Nast, and he was a quirky sort of mercurial character, shy, small, short guy with a sort of interesting reluctance, really, in power, but very, in a way, capricious. Mm-hmm. and strong-willed, and had very strong ideas about what a publishing company should be. Good ones, too. He'd made it into a powerhouse. And then there was the editorial director, who was really the sort of editorial power there, who was called Alexander Lieberman, and he was this Russian emigre, very elegant, very patrician. For an editor, it was a bit like being an artist with Picasso upstairs in the attic. You know, he would come down very with his sort of balletic back, you know, and he would sort of, you know, wander through with a very Douglas Fairbanks moustache, and it was all very grand. And it was very sort of political, lots of power politics. So one of the fun things about reading the diaries was the sort of daily negotiation of politics, trying to figure out, you know, how to be a manager of, in a much bigger pool. Condé Nast seemed to me an amazingly intimidating place. Mm-hmm. After my little tiny job in London. I felt it was like General Motors or something, with, you know, an HR department and a lawyer department and this department.
There was a structure and an org chart.
There was an org chart, and somebody came in and asked me how I wanted to design my office. I was kind of astonished. Right. I just said, a round table, you know. So it was all very exciting. And at one point, I mean, in those days, Condé Nast was such a kind of social place, and you know, the editors used to go for lunch at the Four Seasons, which, you know, it's $250 for a salad at the Four Seasons, but that's where the editors were supposed to go for lunch. And I remember my first lunch there, Alexander Lieberman came down and said, "My dear, I hear I had a piece of rather difficult news yesterday." I said, "What was that?" He said, "Well, I hear you had quite the wrong table at lunch." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, I gather you were sitting in the gallery. I said, "Well, yes, I was sitting in the upstairs of the restaurant." He said, "My dear, that is Siberia." He said, I don't know what he meant, Siberia. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You should be on the main floor, my dear. You should never be sitting in the gallery. I will make sure that we call the maitre d' and make sure that you're seated in the appropriate place in the restaurant." I thought, as I read this, this is unbelievable or funny, really, to read now, when, God knows, I mean, people's expense accounts, I mean, $250 for lunch, I mean, you'd be sort of fired on the spot, probably,
yes,
for doing that. But this was Condé Nast in the 80s, and this is what every editor, you know, was allowed.
It was the good life back then, apparently.
It was a pretty good life, I have to say. It was, it was a time when magazines were very confident and affluent and tons of advertising. I mean, Vanity Fair didn't have any advertising when I arrived. But, you know, Condé Nast itself was booming. And, you know, to be an editor then was to be a very powerful figure. You know, if you were the editor of Time or Newsweek, you know, you were a demigod with a building saying Time and a building saying Newsweek. All of these things have changed, of course, since digital disruption. So it now does feel very much of a sort of portrait of a vanished age, which, mm-hmm, makes it I think, even more piquant to read, really.
One thing that blows me away is, given how ambitious and assertive you are about getting into these roles, you're still not asking for a raise.
Right.
How can that be?
Well, you know, the thing is, as you see in the diary, there's many competing longings and lots of insecurities in there. As I sort of, on the one hand, yes, I have a lot of bravado about my professional sort of confidence, and I know what I can do, and I don't have any sort of self-doubt about that. But I've never, you know, I have a traditional, alas, woman's reticence about sort of asking for money for myself. And after a few years, first of all, I was very grateful every time I was given a little bonus here and a little bonus there. And then when I realized I'd turned around this thing from being on death's door to being a juggernaut, I realized that I actually should be getting paid a heck of a lot more than I was. And then I found to my wrath that the editor of GQ was actually being paid more than I was. And that really did it. You know, I thought that's it. I'm going to get a raise. But I didn't know how to ask for it. So I actually went to an agent. He was known as a super agent at the time, a lawyer, Morten Janklow, who was fantastic negotiator. And I said to Mort, I need your help. And he had a close relationship with Cy Newhouse. He said, listen, I will take care of it. And as it happened, I had just been offered a job by the opposition at Hearst to go and edit Bazaar.
Which is a great time to ask for a raise.
So Mort Janklow said, look, you know, we've just been asked by this is a perfect situation, and there's a job out there you actually would rather like to do. And I said, yeah, I will do that job if I don't get a raise, because it's a great company and it's a great title. So Mort said, perfect, and let me do the rest. And he went and he did get me a big fat raise. And I, to this day, I kind of think, why couldn't I just walk in there and like do that for myself?
Why couldn't you?
Didn't have the confidence. And I still find it very difficult to ask for money for myself. I don't mind asking for it for charity. I don't mind doing it as a fundraiser. You know, I'll be quite aggressive about that if I think it's for something I believe in that I'm raising money for. But if it's about a raise for me, I find it very difficult to do.
When you look at the research, women don't ask for raises very frequently. And as a result, they don't get the raises as a result of that. So it's something to always be thinking of. You obviously, throughout your career, in addition to Vanity Fair, you went to The New Yorker, you turned things around there, you launched The Daily Beast, you were editor-in-chief of Newsweek and The Daily Beast simultaneously. You're the CEO and founder of Tina Brown Live Media, where you launched the Women in the World Summit. That was 2010 that you launched that.
Yep.
I think of that as the original women's conference, because back then there really weren't the number of women's conferences
there
that
we see now. There was kind of two, I think. There was a business conference, and then I launched Women in the World. Women in the World, yeah. I mean, at that time, it was so hard to get anybody to sponsor it. You know, I had a concept that I wanted to bring together extraordinary women who you don't usually hear from, Africa, India, the Middle East, these extraordinary leaders who were kind of facing down amazing repressions in their own countries and didn't really have any place to air their stories, which were remarkable. So that's what I wanted to do. And so we launched Women in the World. I couldn't find anyone to sponsor it. I got one sponsor, HP actually came in as the sort of underwriter. And we went into a small theater in Midtown to launch the first one, which only had 300 attendees. And it sort of immediately found its audience. You know, it really was an idea that's come, that the sense that there was a global women's movement out there that was rustling and murmuring and wanting to be heard. And within 2 years, we had moved to Lincoln Center with an audience of 2,500. And now Women in the World is now a sort of major platform, not, you know, in here and elsewhere. We've done it in Toronto, we've done it in India, we've done it in London, we've done it in Dubai. So it's now something I spend most of my time doing, because it's a very, very rewarding and exciting.
Something that has come up now a lot in the press, and it's coming up certainly at women's conferences, Harvey Weinstein.
Indeed.
Sexual harassment. Harvey Weinstein and you worked together at one point.
Yes, I mean, I left The New Yorker to go and edit a new magazine, found a new magazine in partnership with Miramax, which of course was Harvey Weinstein, which was, I would say, a less shrewd career move, as it turned out.
In retrospect. Was it at the time?
Well, at the time, I think people were pretty stunned that I would leave The New Yorker to go do that. But, you know, I saw, at the time I left The New Yorker, I wanted The New Yorker to be more than just a magazine. I'd done it for nearly 7 years. It was very exciting. But I felt it should become now a radio show, a book publishing company, an events company. I saw a lot more expansion, in a sense, for The New Yorker. I actually was right, as it turns out, but I was also very early in that perception. And Condé Nast didn't see it. They didn't want it. They basically said, go back and edit the magazine. We don't want to do these things. Along comes Harvey Weinstein, who pitched me, in a sense, exactly what I wanted to do. You know, he said, come up to Miramax, start a magazine, you can do a magazine, a book company as well, you can do, you know, we can make movies out of the stories that seem the most movie worthy, etc. And it seemed an irresistible idea. He was doing The English Patient. He was doing Shakespeare in Love. He was doing all of these wonderful movies.
Had you heard anything at that point about...
No, no one had really. I mean, no. No, to me, he was a rough diamond tycoon, you know, Hollywood character who would... A great entrepreneur in his own way, a great entertainment tastemaker. So I did not hear any of those things. And, you know, and nor did I while I was there, except that he clearly like had starlets around him, but I never saw anything untoward like we're hearing now. No, I mean, my problems with him were all just in business. I mean, he was also a very explosive person to work with. And in a way, what we know now, you know, it certainly shocked and surprised me, but it wasn't, you know, at odds, shall we say, with the character that I had to work with.
As more and more of these types of allegations, not just with Weinstein, but others in Hollywood and elsewhere are coming out, more and more of the narratives include this open secret idea, the idea that it was allowed to fester, that there were enablers. Why do you think that is in these positions of great power?
Well, look, I mean, power is intimidating. And people don't want to lose their jobs. I mean, you know, what you can't expect women to go and sort of call the police when, you know, when they have they're applying for a job and they want that job and somebody's behaving inappropriately. You know, they hate it and they resent it and they tell other women about it and they tell colleagues about it and they often tell HR about it. But one thing we've learned in the last period really is that, you know, HR is often not your friend. I mean, we did actually at Women in the World in April a fabulous panel on this very topic ahead of all of this with the lawyer who represents Gretchen Carlson. And she came up with a memorable phrase. She said, you know, HR is not your friend. You know, HR can be like the Stasi. They are basically
working
for management.
They're there to
protect the company. Yeah, they're right. There to protect the company. So the last thing they're going to do is empower a protester about sexual harassment to kind of take it further. Their role is going to be to suppress it, keep it quiet, brush it under the carpet, and preferably like ease her out. So that is what I think is such a lousy deal, in a sense, for women, that they do feel, I don't have anywhere to go with this protest. You know, I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why so unfairly women often decide they will be the ones to just leave because they don't like it.
And they'd rather opt out than face it.
They'd rather opt out, which is why it was so outrageous, I think it was, when Donald Trump's junior said, you know, I would expect if Ivanka was harassed, I would expect her just to leave, you know, go and get a job somewhere else. I was thinking, well, actually, A, you know, Ivanka isn't going to get harassed because she's such a powerful girl, you know. And secondly, it's like, wait, you know, this is the whole problem. Women should not feel they have to leave because they're doing a good job and someone's harassing them. So, you know, it's very good there's a reset at this point. Even if it goes somewhat too far, it is very good that we're having the reset.
Did you ever face issues like that along the way in your career, and how did you address them? I know you talked about the fact that a number of the men just were disrespectful to you. They would never accept your successes or celebrate them.
I my major issues were with that much more than they were about ever feeling that I was in a sexually threatened situation. But, you know, I was also lucky because, you know, I was a boss lady, very young, you know. So ultimately,
if you can hire and fire the guy.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel, and Cy Newhouse, for whom I worked for 18 years, you know, was sort of the perfect gentleman. So I never had that issue where a superior, you know, was making me feel uncomfortable in some way, which I think is a completely unforgivable situation to put a woman in. So in that sense, I was very lucky. And it was only because I was so young and such that I was had a big job so young that I think that I was in that position. I think it's very, very different if you're in a position where, you know, you are economically dependent on a person who is definitely expecting sexual favors in return for promotion. And that is something that I think so many women face. You know, I think in retail and in the food and beverage business, it's a huge problem. I think we've seen it to be a huge problem in Wall Street. We've seen it problem in the military. So this is something that is not discreet to Hollywood by any means.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've been covering these stories like you have for so many years. And I know it's cross industries. It's across age ranges. It's just unbelievable how prevalent it actually is. When you look back on all of this, all of the career, what's been the toughest lesson for you to learn along the way?
I think how much harder you have to try as a woman to sort of get the same level of opportunity and respect, if you like. I think I've always felt, and I think a lot of the women I know feel, you know, you just have, you always feel that you're on audition in some way, that it's that's what I think is the differential between women who are succeeding and men who are succeeding, and a sense that, you know, the standards are higher for you if you're a woman, that you have to prove and prove, you know, that you deserve it. And that can get a bit old, I would say, after a time. And I think what's great about having more women moving into positions of power and authority is that that's women will be able to relax more a bit into their roles, that they won't feel so constantly on trial.
As a woman who's also been a hiring manager throughout your career, do you see that playing out in the interviews? For example, do the women show up more prepared on average than the men to the interviews?
Yes, I think that's certainly true. I mean, it depends. You know, listen, I have worked with amazing men. Let's really make
absolutely.
It clear. I mean, you know, my colleagues at, you know, the Vanity Fair, the New Yorker, ever after, I have worked with the most amazing men. At the New Yorker, I brought in some amazing men, you know, David Remnick and Malcolm Gladwell and Jeffrey Toobin and some of these fabulous writers who were very, very wonderful colleagues too, and with whom I had a fantastic time. I mean, sometimes I did feel that a man getting bad news from me about the quality of their work was doubly resented. So there was a certain amount of tension at times when I felt that a male writer was feeling, you know, doubly sort of angry and somewhat humiliated to be hearing from me that the work wasn't good enough. So I think women managers sometimes have that issue with men, that they resent from a woman manager something they wouldn't resent as much from a male manager. But most of the time I found, you know, it's all been about a wonderful collegiality, actually. I mean, I think the Vanity Fair Diaries is really a sort of love affair about a career, in a sense, you know, I love the whole process of making magazines, you know, putting pictures on a page, writing captions. I mean, some of the happiest moments in the book are when I'm with my sort of team of writers and editors and photographers, and we're all sitting around brainstorming late at night, and it's like putting on a school play. You know, you're all heading for the final moment when the curtain goes up and the magazine goes to press, and tremendous warmth and that teamwork, which I think is a very happy thing. And I hope, you know, that in this kind of digital era when people are so isolated and behind their screens, that people will still have the understanding that collaboration and teamwork is just so rewarding. And the sublimation of self into the bigger than you, which is that you're all working towards the same goal, whether it's in team sports or whether it's putting on a magazine or, you know, a launch of anything, product or newspaper or whatever it is you're doing. It's a very, very exciting thing to be with a group of people who are each kind of helping each other and supporting each other and respecting each other. It's just nothing like it, really.
Are the best of times behind us?
I think it's a challenging time. You know, I think it's a very challenging time. There's a lot of atomization. You know, funny enough, in Vanity Fair in 1991, we ran a wonderfully prescient piece, just the turn of the decade, actually, 1990. Stephen Schiff, he wrote a piece called Particle People about how the coming sort of computer age was going to make us all fly apart. You know, there was less coherence to our world. And I think that that is certainly true, that lack of sort of communal coherence, the constant pursuit of self and narcissism, you know, in a way dramatized by the selfie. The selfie is the sort of quintessential statement of our times.
Have you ever taken a selfie, Tina?
You know, I don't like taking selfies. I mean, I just think this endless kind of grinning into a camera you hold out in front of you, it's like it's just so kind of, you know, who cares?
It's really embarrassing when you sit there and you try to get the good selfie.
You know, the good selfie. And I mean, how many selfies do we keep? You know, I don't think that selfies, you know, are the thing pictures that you keep. They really aren't.
Well said. So if I'm 22 and I come to you today and I say, Tina, I want to get into this industry, what do you say to me?
I say, jump into something small and which you have control of. It doesn't have to be a big thing.
A small magazine.
A small magazine, a small digital site, a small, you know, anything. Because if it's small and it doesn't have much of a budget, but you are the person doing it, it's actually much better than being a cog in a big machine. I mean, I would rather be, you know, putting out a small thing called, you know, Dog and Hound or something, then I would be an assistant editor at, you know, I don't know, the Wall Street Journal. Because I know that I'm going to, you know, you'll learn so much more if you're the person who has to figure it out, do it, you know, no money to get anybody to say yes. You've got to persuade people to do it. You have to then make something of it when it comes in. You have to find a picture. You know, you have to write a headline. You have to, you know, create the social media strategy for someone to read it. You have to, I mean, all of that. Doing it yourself is going to make you so much more valuable as an employee than someone who's just been, frankly, you know, answering the phone and getting the coffee for some big shot who takes no notice of you. So I would say do that. I would say jump into something small, however unappealing it might look from a distance.
What's the worst advice you've received?
Oh, God. Go and work for Harvey Weinstein at Mirror.
Who told you to do that?
Well, you know, people I spoke to thought this was, you know, and it was at the time. It seemed like it, but it turned out that it wasn't so. So that's probably not the best advice I've ever received.
Tina Brown, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
And now it's time for our No Limits Entrepreneur of the Week, where we feature one of our listeners who's building something of her own. And our No Limits Entrepreneur this week is Kelly Howard. She is the CEO of 860 South, which is a strategic communications agency. She was nominated by Tara Khan Malik. Kelly is currently based in Los Angeles, but she was originally born and raised in Owatonna, Minnesota. Love a Minnesota girl. Love anyone who gets their start there, because I did. She graduated from Iowa State University in 2008 with a degree in journalism and mass communications. As I'm sure all of you remember, 2008 was peak financial crisis, therefore a very difficult time to get a job. Kelly says she sent out nearly 400 resumes and received an offer from Kit Morrison & Associates, a fashion, beauty, and lifestyle PR firm in the heart of L.A., where she remained for 3.5 years before making the move to the communications company Post & Beam in 2013. Kelly spent 4 years as Post & Beam's West Coast director, and then at the end of 2016, she acquired and rebranded the business, and 860 South was born. Kelly made rebranding a priority and streamlined the company's focus to fashion, beauty, and lifestyle. Because there was already an existing business infrastructure in place when she took over, she was able to focus on setting up 860 South as its own entity. One of her biggest challenges has been managing the day-to-day responsibilities, compounded now with the responsibilities it takes to run a business. Kelly says to manage both successfully, it requires her to let go and delegate to the team as needed. She says she couldn't do it without her team, and as a business owner, assembling a team of true talent that you can trust is one of her greatest rewards. If she could go back and give herself advice, she says go with your gut, but recognize that good things take time. She also says don't compare your behind the scenes to someone else's highlight reel, as in Instagram. Very good advice. Congratulations to Kelly Howard. I wish you and 860 South continued success, and thank you to Tara for the great nomination. Remember, if you or someone you know should be featured here on No Limits as an entrepreneur, send me your nomination to nolimitswithrjpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's nolimitswithrjpodcast@gmail.com. I love hearing from all of you. I love reading your emails, so keep them coming. You can obviously also reach me on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Rebecca Jarvis. Don't forget to use the hashtag No Limits. And before we go, a shout out to the fabulous team here who makes this happen week after week. Our producer, Taylor Dunn, our editor, Michelle Boncardo, our research assistant, Annie Osakwe, and the rest of the team here at ABC Radio, Elizabeth Russo, David Rind, Josh Cohan, Andrew Kelb, and Steve Jones. Thanks to all.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.